Hello, Mr. Kim is here again. I'm on page 24 in the book. Title of the page, Amino Acids and Polypeptides. We are still in chapter 2, or in topic 2, which is about biochemistry and the topic molecular biology. So top left box, drawing amino acids. You see the structural formula of an amino acid here. These are the building blocks of polypeptides slash proteins. Okay, and I'm going to explain you now the general structure of an amino acid. Okay, so the first thing is let's try to find the central carbon atom over here, and that is not labeled over here. The central carbon atom is the one in the middle, the C in the middle, which has the N attached to it on the left, the R on the top, another C on the right, and the hydrogen on to the towards the bottom. That's the middle one, the middle carbon. Easy to find. Circle it and label it central carbon atom. To the left of the central carbon atom, we have a nitrogen, an N. And this N has two H's, two hydrogens attached to it. And the two hydrogens, together with the N, is referred to as the amine group. And it's an NH2 group, and you might want to circle this one as well, the NH2 group, and label it with amine. On the opposite end, we have another carbon atom. And this carbon atom has an oxygen double bonded to it, and also an OH group. And this is known as the carboxyl group. It's also known as the COOH group. You might also want to circle that one and label it as carboxyl group. At the central carbon atom, you see that on the bottom there's a hydrogen. That's clear, forget about it. But on the top there's an R. And this R is the rest or R group or radical group, and different amino acids have a different R. And there are 20 amino acids around that we use in living things, and these 20 amino acids have a different R. And the simplest kind of R that you can possibly imagine would be a hydrogen. Okay, but in many cases it's actually much larger. Okay, it can be a long carbon chain or whatever, or it could also be a CH3 group. Doesn't matter. The point is the simplest R can be a hydrogen. Okay, so we now go down one box and we talk about amino acid diversity. And this box talks specifically about this R group. Okay, it says that the R group is variable. It's different between different amino acids. Okay, now theoretically, it is possible to invent any type of R and have it there. However, in living things, there are only 20 distinct types. I mean, you can go out and you can invent your own amino acids, but they're not used by living things, okay? Just know there are 20 different amino acids used in living things. The other thing is that the same 20 amino acids are used in all living things. In that sense, there is a big similarity among organisms, among all organisms. And the fact that all living things use the same 20 amino acid is further evidence that all living things have a common ancestor. Now, there are some organisms that also use different amino acids, but these different amino acids are not used by ribosomes to make polypeptides. They're different biochemical mechanisms in using them and in cooperating them. So this actually means that it's not a falsification of the theory, but simply it's a kind of a special case. Yeah. Which actually further supports the fact that all living things have a common ancestry. So let's move on. Polypeptides and proteins on the top right. What is the difference between a polypeptide and a protein and all these things? Okay. So first of all, a polypeptide is a chain of amino acids. Okay, it's a single chain. A dipeptide, for example, is two amino acids joined together. A polypeptide are many amino acids joined together. Now, what is a protein? A protein is chemically pretty much the same thing, but it is either made of one or more polypeptide chains. Okay, that is a protein. Okay, give you an example: an antibody. Or also known as an immunoglobulin. The antibodies are those things that are produced by our immune system to attack antigens. And antibodies have four polypeptide chains, but one antibody is a protein. but it's made of four polypeptide chains. So just an example here. Now, theoretically, it is possible to create an incredible variety of different polypeptides depending on which amino acids you connect together in what way. I mean, you have 26 letters in the alphabet. How many words can you make, or how many sentences can you write? And polypeptides can be a few hundred amino acids long. Not every sentence makes sense, of course. Yeah, and the same thing is also in living things. You can theoretically make polypeptides that don't really do anything or that don't make sense. Yeah, but theoretically, you can make a very large number. Okay, so living things actually only make a small amount of the things which are theoretically possible. Okay. Now, some polypeptides are made in very large quantities because they're quite useful. I mean, for example, here, protein, I mean, here is made in large quantity because it's necessary, okay? What the box also says that over 2 million polypeptides have so far been discovered in living organisms, okay? That's quite a lot, okay? Now, how is this whole thing linked to DNA and genes, okay? Now, the sequence, the type and sequence of amino acids that are used to make a polypeptide, this information is written on the DNA. So the purpose of the DNA is to carry the information on how to make different polypeptides. Yeah. And this piece of DNA, or the segment of DNA, which codes for a protein, this one is referred to as a gene. Yeah, so it's one gene, one polypeptide. Yeah? And then here at the bottom we again have is that a protein consists either of a single polypeptide or more than one polypeptide. It's somehow linked together. Okay. So next box, what is a proteome? Proteins and proteomes. The word proteome refers to all of the proteins which are produced by a cell. Now, the important thing is to understand is the following. It's an interesting point here, that all of the cells of my body contain the same DNA. However, the proteomes are different. So if I analyze the proteins of a skin cell, for example, then of course there are different proteins there than, for example, the cell of, a gland producing a hormone. That one produces again different proteins, or a nerve cell, or a muscle cell, okay? They all have the same DNA, but the proteins that they make are different. And the reason is because the different cells express different genes. And when I say express to different genes, then this means use different parts of the DNA to make different proteins, okay? So that even though the information is there, it's stored in the DNA, not every cell uses the same DNA to make proteins. And that's the reason why different cells make different proteins, and that's why different cells are specialized in different ways, okay? That's basically the idea of this. And this, the photograph in here, these black spots, that's a gel electrophoresis, and each one of these black spots, that's a different, represents a different protein, okay? So, the point is still within a species, the proteomes still are, of course, more similar. Of course, if I analyze the proteins of two humans, then they're going to be, of course, more similar because they're two humans. But within the human being, the different cells, if you look specifically, will also have, of course, will make different proteins, as I just said. Next box, peptide bonds and polypeptides. The thing is the following. I already mentioned this before. Amino acids are joined together, and the bond between an amine group and a carboxylic acid group, that is known as a peptide bond. Okay, and if you join two amino acids together to form a peptide bond, you make one molecule of water. Okay, so if you join five amino acids together, you will make four peptide bonds and four molecules of water. Okay. So that is pretty much it, and over here is in the drawing you see the peptide bond, and you see that the peptide bond is between the nitrogen, the N, and the carbon, but you see that the N has two carbons, one on the left and one of the right. So which carbon is it? Well, it's the carbon with a double bonded oxygen. That is known as the peptide bond. Okay, we move on to page 25. Page 25 about protein structure and function. And the box on the left has the term protein conformation. The word conformation is a biochemical term, which you have to know. And conformation refers to the three-dimensional structure of a protein. Okay, you have to understand that polypeptides, chains of amino acids, they are not just floating around as a string inside a cell, but they kind of fold up into a three-dimensional shape, and that's important because they have to do certain things, and if you're just floating around as straight strings, then they're not able to do anything. They don't have a structure, a proper three-dimensional structure, okay? And it is like this. What determines this folding? Well, amino acids that are present determine how the protein folds, obviously. Among other things, I mean, I'm studied molecular biology, and the protein folding is incredibly complicated. It's a whole area of research, yeah. So, but it doesn't matter. Okay. Now, it is point is the following: if a ribosome makes two polypeptides with the same amino acid sequence, then they should have the same conformation. They should fold up in the same way. Okay. And the question is now, what holds the structure in place? Well, it is the so-called intramolecular bonds. These are, for example, hydrogen bonds and van der Waals bonds, sometimes even covalent bonds. They hold the structure in place. And we're now going to have a look at one of these proteins down here. You see a pretty complex-looking drawing with a lot of spirals. And you see a dotted line. Two dotted lines, two horizontal dotted lines. And these dotted lines there, that is supposed to represent the cell membrane. So you see it's a protein that is anchored inside a cell membrane. And if you go back to page topic one, if you go back to page 9, it says here membrane proteins on the bottom. You see some of the schematic drawings of how the proteins are linked or embedded in the membrane on page 9 on the bottom, right? And now what we have over here on page 25, we have a more detailed drawing of this. And one of the things that you see, you will see two structures. You will see a lot of spiral shapes, and these spirals are known as alpha helix. It's an alpha helix, or alpha helices in plural. And towards the top, very difficult to see a little bit, but you see some light gray, you see some thin strings, and you see some light gray, slightly wider structures. And these light gray structures, these are so-called the beta sheets. So you have alpha helices, easy to see, and beta sheets. And these beta sheets, these are the ones in light gray. These are actually supposed to represent little arrows. Okay. So that is an example of a sodium-potassium pump, okay? Just for your information here, yeah, and how it actually looks like and what protein conformation is. Okay, so let's move on to the next box, denaturation. Denaturation is when a protein changes irreversibly its structure and therefore loses its function, and this is because to high heat or extreme pH values. Okay, so denaturation is, in other words, in simple English, when a protein breaks and doesn't work anymore. Okay, heat causes a refolding of the protein conformation. So the proteins refold into a different three-dimensional structure, and therefore stays like that then irreversibly, and it loses its function. Classic example, the frying of an egg, the boiling of meat, for example. And you know you cannot unfry and unboil an egg because the meat and the egg proteins, once they have denatured due to heat, they will stay like that. Okay. The next one is extremes of pH. So every protein has its own optimum pH. It doesn't have to be the neutral pH 7. Okay. So for example, proteins, the enzymes in your stomach, they might prefer a low pH. Okay. And for them, a neutral pH might be an extreme pH. Okay. So that's important to understand. Every enzyme has its optimum pH. And if the pH goes too far above or too far below this optimum pH, then it's going to denature and it's going to lose its function. Later on, I'm going to talk about the diagrams on page 27 about the effect of temperature and the effect of pH. Okay, so I'm going to go back to this. But for right now, you have to know what denaturation is. Okay. That is essentially it. You see over here in the picture, of course, a fried egg, and over here you see some also some protein, I suppose, also some egg white in acid or in a strong base, and you see it also turns white. If you want, you can easily try this also at home, taking some egg white, and then adding some strong acid, like, be careful, citric acid would be okay, yeah, I guess, because you can also buy this. For food. So next one, doesn't matter. Functions of proteins, bottom box on page 25. There are six different examples of proteins, and you should know some of these examples, okay? And the idea, the overall idea of this box is to show you that even though all proteins are made of 20 amino acids, proteins can do a lot of different things. They are the ones in the cell that actually do the work, okay? And that is basically the bottom line of this box. So, an enzyme, the first one. Rubisco is the name of an enzyme which is the most common enzyme in nature, which is used for photosynthesis. Okay, so proteins can be enzymes. For example, Rubisco, which is used in photosynthesis, it's the most common enzyme. Proteins can be hormones. For example, insulin, that's point number two. Okay, and insulin is a hormone which is important for regulating blood glucose. Okay, so also I think these things can be really summarized quite quickly, okay? You just read through the whole thing, but then you simply remember. Next example, next protein could be an antibody, okay? Immunoglobulins are antibodies, okay? And what they do is they bind to antigens to fight them off, okay? Another example, point four, proteins can be pigments. For example, rhodopsin, which can be found inside the retina, inside the eye, which is a light-sensitive protein. Okay, it absorbs light. Or proteins can be structural proteins, point number five. For example, collagen. And this collagen makes sure that organs are held together, or for example, that skin is held together. It's a very tough protein, okay? I mean, if you pull on your skin, it doesn't come off, right? It holds together. Well, what makes the cells hold together? It's a collagen over here, okay? Or another example, proteins can be structural proteins. For example, spider's silk, okay? Very strong protein. And you see that all of these, they look very different, they have different properties, different characteristics. Still, they're made of the same 20 amino acids, simply arranged differently, okay? It kind of shows you, as I said before, the vast diversity of protein function. This also basically is what life is. I mean, different, the substances of living things, right? Okay, so it doesn't matter. We move on. I'm on page now 26, and now we talk specifically about enzymes, which is one specific example of a protein function. Okay, so enzyme over here, this was number one on page 25 on the functions of proteins, Rubisco. Okay, so how do enzymes work? Okay, and that's something I'm going to explain right now. So on page 26 on the left, you see substrates and active sites. This is a long box on the left side. And I'm going to explain the drawings now, okay? You see four stages or four steps. First of all, on the left in the top drawing, that's this little large thing. That's called the enzyme. And those little balls that you see, okay, these are the individual atoms that make up this enzyme, okay? And on the right, you have the substrate. And the substrate is referred to as the substance that the enzyme acts on, okay? And look what happens. I'm going to explain you this drawing first before I talk about the details. You see that in the second drawing, the substrate binds against the enzyme to form a so-called enzyme-substrate complex. And you can also see that the enzyme and the substrate, they fit together like a lock and a key. This is the so-called lock and key principle, important for you to know. And the place where the substrate binds on the enzyme, this place, which kind of fit together like a puzzle piece, okay? This place on the enzyme is called its active site. This active site, okay? So the substrate binds, step one, the substrate binds to the enzyme on the active site of the enzyme. And then a chemical reaction will take place, which the enzyme triggers. And in this case, the third drawing, the substrate is split into two, okay? And then you have a so-called an enzyme product complex. Okay, and then when this has been finished at the very last stage, the two products are then released from the enzyme, and the enzyme is not used up in this process. The enzyme can now be used to catalyze another chemical reaction. So what this enzyme does is the following: it breaks the substrate into two substances, okay, into two products. Yeah. So a few things that you have to know. If they ask you any general question about enzymes, what are you going to write down? Okay. So first of all, you say enzymes are proteins. Enzymes are also known as catalysts. So what they do is they speed up chemical reactions. It's also very important. You have to say that enzymes are very substrate specific. This means that for every specific substrate, separate subset, you need a separate enzyme. So you do not have an enzyme that is can be general and one enzyme that does everything, okay? No, it doesn't work, okay? They got to be very specific. And the reason is because the enzyme has an active site which only binds against very specific substrates, okay? Another point that you want to write down is that in the process, the enzyme is not used up. So the enzyme, but actually if you're in chemistry, that's the definition of a catalyst, okay? It's not used up in the process. And it can be there to again catalyze a new reaction after it has done that. Okay, so that is basically it. Okay, in simple terms, enzymes make chemical reactions possible that normally would be too unlikely to happen. So normally, this substrate in the drawing here would not break up into two parts. Okay, and if you really like to have a more chemical definition over here, then you can also say enzymes work by lowering the activation energy of a specific chemical reaction. Okay, they lower the activation energy. Especially if you're in chemistry, you might be more happy with that type of definition. Okay, so 26 on the top, immobilized enzymes and the production of lactose-free milk. You know what? I'm going to explain you first the production of lactose-free milk, because, and then I can talk about the immobilized enzymes, because it kind of goes together, these two boxes. Okay, so what is the idea? The idea is how can we use enzymes in food production or for commercial purposes? I mean, enzymes are part of our cells, of course, part of living things, but we want to use them also for commercial purposes. We want to make use of them. Okay, so one of these examples is the production of lactose-free milk, because lactose in milk is not very good for people who are lactose intolerant. And then if they drink the milk, they get diarrhea, they get cramps and all sorts of things, and you don't like that. So you make lactose-free milk. And the thing is how do you remove the lactose? You break it down, okay? And one way could be is you will simply add enzymes, right? You just get the enzyme in powdered form, you put it into the milk and let it digest away the lactose. The lactose is then broken down into glucose and galactose. Lactose is gone. But the problem with that is we're adding enzyme to it, which is expensive. Okay, so we're kind of losing the enzyme, right? It would be kind of cool if we would not mix it with the milk, if we could get the enzyme back out, or if we wouldn't even mix it in, right? Because it's expensive. So, and that's basically the idea over here. Okay, so let me summarize the equation here. Lactose on the left side, and then there's an arrow, lactase. The enzyme is called lactase, and if we add this to the milk, we get glucose and galactose. Okay, and now we want to have a system in getting rid of the lactose without losing the enzyme. And what we're doing here on the drawing here, it looks kind of complex, but it is complex, but it's actually not so difficult to understand. First of all, what we do is we kind of make the enzyme, we mix the enzyme in so-called in sodium alginate, okay? So we have sodium alginate, it's a substance, and lactase, and these are little, and if you drop it in there, then we have those little beads formed, okay? Little ball-shaped structures, and these ball-shaped structures contain the enzyme caught in them. And that's these are so-called immobilized enzymes. They're sticking to this bead, right? And then what we're doing here on the right side is we're filling the whole syringe with these beads, and then we're pouring milk over it. And kind of what happens is the following, that the milk kind of seeps through between these beads, like almost like in a filter, you know. And as it gets in contact with the enzyme in the beads, the lactose is broken down. And on the bottom side, we have now the finished milk, the milk coming out without lactose. Okay. And this way, because the beads are not... they get in contact with the milk, but they're not really intermixed with it, so they're not in the milk then, because we're kind of keeping them back, right? And for this reason, we can make a lactose-free milk, and this has a whole bunch of advantages, as it's pointed down at the bottom, okay? So many people are lactose intolerant, it says here, and they cannot drink more than about a quarter of a liter of milk a day, okay, unless it's lactose-reduced. Galactose and glucose are sweeter, so it actually makes the milk taste sweeter, because lactose doesn't taste sweet, but now glucose and galactose, they taste kind of sweet, okay? And sometimes you also use this, you use lactose-free milk when you produce ice cream, because you don't want the lactose to crystallize out, okay? And bacteria ferment glucose and galactose more quickly than lactose, so it's actually lactose-free milk is also better when you make yogurt, okay? So it has also a couple of other advantages as well. But again, the point here is that you're making your beads, your alginate beads, containing the lactase, That's the enzyme. You're filling these beads into the syringe, you're pouring the milk over it, and the beads are not lost in the process, the enzyme is not lost. Okay, so and now I can go up to the top box called immobilized enzymes, because that's actually what it is. It's called immobilized, they're not, yeah, they're fixed, the enzymes are fixed. And there are a whole bunch of advantages, and I'm just going to mention a few of them here. Advantages of producing lactose-free milk this way is you can control the whole process better by adding or removing enzymes. So you can adjust the concentration of the enzymes better. The general enzyme concentrations can also be much higher. Okay, you can reuse the enzymes. You save money this way. That's actually what I told you before. If you just mix the free enzyme into the milk, you're kind of losing the enzyme, right? And enzymes are more resistant to higher temperature and extremes of pH. They're more denaturing resistant. And the milk is not contaminated with enzymes, because some people might not want to drink the milk which contains the lactase floating around in it, okay? And what can you do? Three examples here is you can attach the enzyme to surfaces such as glass. It's called adsorption. You can trap it into a gel. That's alginate. That's the one that I just showed you. Okay, or you can kind of bond them and link them together. Okay, and that's also a possibility. And then they're not mixed in. Okay, so that is this was page 26. Okay. So I quickly explained how enzymes work, and I explained you how enzymes can be used in biotechnology, using enzymes in the production of lactose-free milk. Okay, now we move on to page 27. Factors affecting enzyme activity. Three things, okay? The three factors I'm going to explain. It's substrate concentration, temperature, and pH, okay? The important thing is how can you measure, this is just a general thing, is how can you measure the enzyme activity? You can measure enzyme activity by either measuring how fast is a substrate used up or how fast is a product formed, okay? Both of this can be used to measure enzyme activity, and the more faster a substrate is used up, the faster the enzyme works. So in other words, this page tries to explain how can temperature and pH and substrate concentration, how can it affect the speed of an enzyme working, okay? So important is you have to, in the first box, factors affecting enzyme activity, really doesn't tell us a lot. It just tells you that if you have an enzyme, you got to make sure that the temperature and the pH and substrate concentrations are right. Otherwise, they don't work very well, and then, that's not something you don't want, okay? And that's the top left box, okay? And now I'm going to start off with substrate concentration. You have to know these curves, okay? It says here on the x-axis you have the substrate concentration, that's our independent variable, and the enzyme activity is always on the y-axis, it's always our dependent variable. Enzyme activity measured as substrate used up or products produced per time. And if the substrate concentration is very low, then of course also the enzyme activity is low, because the enzyme is not able to make any products because there are no substrates there to use. Okay, so and then if you increase the substrate concentration, it goes up, but at a very high concentration, the curve levels off. And yet increasing substrate concentration still further will not increase enzyme activity. And the reason is, and that's now important, because the active sites of the enzymes are always occupied. Okay, the enzymes are already working at maximum speed. Yeah, the only thing that you can now do is you go up with the enzyme concentration, right? Yeah, but then you have again a new curve that looks the same way, right? So if it levels off and you want to have more products made, then you got to add more enzyme, sure, okay? But then you have again a curve that looks like this, okay? Just leveling off at a higher level, yeah? So that means the point is, that is basically how it works. At low substrate concentrations, there's low enzyme activity, because don't forget, there's the substrates kind of, they move around, okay, and they bump into the enzyme. Right, and if the substrate concentration is too high, then if they bump into the enzyme, then it might already be occupied because another substrate has already bound to it. Yeah, so it's not going to go further. Okay, effect of temperature. That is something that you already know, because I told you that temperature is important, right? And again, here on the x-axis we have temperature, on the y-axis we have enzyme activity. At low temperature, the enzyme activity is low because at low temperature, there are generally a lower number of collisions between the substrate and the active site. Okay, but at low temperature, it's reversible. This is the reason why we have a refrigerator. By cooling down the food, the enzymes in the bacteria in the food, they work slower, a bacteria reproduce less quickly. Fruits also ripen much slower in the refrigerator because the enzymes that are important for the ripening process work slower. But it's a reversible process. If I cool something down, then the enzyme activity is going to go down. But if I warm it up again, then it's going to go up again. Up to an optimum temperature. Okay, and if you go up with a temperature too much, then after that point, it's going to drop very quickly down, because the enzyme denatures, and this then is irreversible. Okay? Once the temperature has been too high, the enzyme breaks. The enzyme, the enzyme denatures, the enzyme activity drops sharply, and then the enzyme, even if you cool it down later on, the enzyme is not going to work anymore. Okay? So that is the effect of temperature and the effect of pH. You see on the x-axis pH, okay, and on the y-axis enzyme activity again, and you see that there's a peak. And if you have a pH value which is too high or too low on both sides, it drops sharply because the enzyme, believe it or not, denatures. Okay, extremes of pH cause the enzyme to denature. It says here that the pH 7 is the optimum for most enzymes. Yeah, but I mean, enzymes which are important for digesting proteins in your stomach might have an optimum pH of, let's say, pH 2. Okay, while the enzymes in your saliva might have an optimum pH of around pH 7 because our saliva is neutral or at least very, very slightly alkaline. Okay, but the point is, yeah, you have a curve that looks like this kind of bell-shaped distribution curve, okay? So that is it, okay? You gotta know the drawings, the shapes of these, and also know where you have the x and the y-axis, okay? Next one, designing enzyme experiments. Well, let's be very honest. That's a very general thing. What is the independent variable? What is the dependent variable? And what are the controlled variables? The independent variables are those that you change in a controlled, the ones that you have control over, you change that, okay? And you modify that. Some people also refer to this as the manipulated variable. So for example, to use the enzyme examples over here, you change the substrate concentration around, okay? And the dependent variable is now how does the enzyme activity respond? And then you have to have a way on how to measure that. For example, the amount of substrate being used up or product being produced, that's the dependent variable, yeah? The measurement should be quantitative. That means it should be in numbers. You got to have some kind of values, okay? And you have to be able to replicate the results. And what this means is if you repeat the experiment, you should get pretty much more or less the same values. If not, it shows that there is a flaw in your experiment, okay? And the controlled variables, number three down here, are all of those factors that you keep the same. So for example, if you want to investigate the effect of substrate concentration on the enzyme activity, you have to keep the temperature and the pH the same. Okay? That is important. You only change the independent variable. Okay? So that is, and there's a little drawing down here. Okay? So it's simply an example here. Here they're trying to control the temperature. Okay, so you have got the temperature in a water bath at a certain temperature, and you have got the substrate in a water bath at a certain temperature. You measure this, and only when they have the same temperature, then you mix them together. Because if one of them is too cold, or colder than the other one, or warmer than the other one, then this is going to change the effect of temperature. Okay. So either you can now change the substrate concentration at the same temperature, or maybe you would like to have investigate the effect of temperature, then you have to change the water bath temperature, okay? So whatever you do, you got to make sure that you keep everything the same, except the independent variable which you change around, okay? So this was page 27 right now, okay? That was it. That was everything I want to say about proteins for right now. I wish you a nice day. Bye.